This meeting of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:05 on Tuesday, May 6th. Members present are Representative Costello, Representative Rauscher, Co-Chair Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Holland. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. I'll also note that we're allowing the use of electronic devices during committee meetings. Just a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to the committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Shana Kilcoyne, and she'll take care of it. And importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary, and today Emma Turner from the Juno LAO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have four presenters today and two more on Thursday who are exploring the vast energy potential in Alaska. Co-Chair Mears and I have been looking forward to this conversation. We're historically recognized for our oil and gas reserves, but as the global energy landscape evolves, Alaska is also poised to leverage its significant renewable energy resources. This presents a remarkable opportunity for Alaska to tap into a new export market. Resources ranging from the Outer Continental Shelf's minerals, offshore wind, geothermal, and even tidal are being explored to meet future energy demands and drive economic growth, not just to benefit the local Cook Inlet region and its need for energy, but as a source for new state of Alaska energy import substitutions and energy exports. Key initiatives are underway to develop this potential, focusing on both domestic energy needs and export markets. Along with oil and gas, we could export hydrogen, whether it's as a synthetic aviation fuel or hydrogen in the form of hydrogen gas or liquid ammonia for export to countries like Japan and South Korea. Additionally, there is strong push to develop a plan for producing sustainable aircraft fuel at the Anchorage Airport, which has become a critical refueling hub for cargo planes flying from Asia to America. These sources might also hold the promise of providing low-cost clean electric power for Alaskans and Alaskan mines. There's a lot of potential that we're going to hear about today, and it's our hope that we can develop an understanding of where this technology is and whether Alaska has a unique competitive advantage in pursuing any of these projects, and not just being a state supplying conventional energy needed now, but the energy the world will need to power the world of future generations. Our first presenter is Givi Kowanowski. Givi is the Regional Director, Alaska Region, of the Bureau of Ocean Engineering Energy Management, or BOEM. Mr. Kowanowski, if you could begin your presentation. I think our committee aide, Shana, is here with the slides. And as you move along, if you can let us know which slide you'd like to be on, that will help us make sure we stay in sync with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify to the chairs, the co-chairs, and the committee. I've met with all of you in the past. I look forward to our conversation today. This is a wonderful panel to be part of because all those testifying have been working with BOEM over the last several years, so this is an ongoing dialogue about the opportunities for our state. Moving to slide two, I'd like to kind of highlight our jurisdiction as an agency for your awareness. We have divided Alaska's Outer Continental Shelf, which is one-third of the entire United States, about a billion-plus acres, into 16 planning areas. New this year is a high Arctic planning area. It was just added by the Trump administration. And then, germane to today's discussion, we have a dedicated Cook Inlet planning area that runs roughly from Nikiski south to the bottom of Shelikof Strait. So many of the projects being discussed today fall within the Cook Inlet planning area. For the past 2 years, our region has been extremely committed towards focusing on energy opportunities in Cook Inlet, and we established a joint federal-state work group called the Cook Inlet Work Group focused on energy opportunities of all sorts in the Cook Inlet planning area. Stakeholders, industry, NGOs, as well as state and federal agencies all participate in the opportunities to discuss ways to advance Cook Inlet development. Moving on to slide three, this is a brief overview of our capabilities as an office, and I'll briefly get into these in a little more detail, but we basically have three lines of business in our region. One that looks at the resources of Alaska, our resource evaluation team of what the monetary and potential development values are. We have a strong commitment per statute and in structure to the environment. We have a studies program and an environmental compliance section in our team. And then we also engage with industry through our leasing and plants program. So regardless of what type of energy or mineral project someone might be pursuing in the Outer Continental Shelf of Alaska, all three of those offices will engage to help industry and stakeholders navigate forward. Slide, please. On slide four, this is a highlight of the traditional conventional energy resources of Alaska that certainly is in line with the current executive orders on unleashing Alaska's resource potential, energy dominance, and the focus on generating more energy nationwide and utilizing Alaska more effectively. We have about 47 billion barrels of oil technically recoverable as a resource in the federal waters of Alaska, and that does also include Cook Inlet. Slide, please, to slide five. Another up-and-coming area that we're diligently working on, and there was recently as a week and a half ago, was a new executive order about offshore mineral development and strategic minerals in federal waters. Our state is rich in offshore minerals across much of the state. Cook Inlet is pretty sparse for marine minerals, but there are other resources that we are looking at in that region, which we'll get to on the next slide. Slide six, please. Carbon's geological storage of carbon is a big deal. It's a priority that has come from a few years back, and the Inflation Reduction Act continues under this administration. And as you can see from the map, the areas shaded in purple are opportune for geological storage of carbon, which goes hand in glove with many other technologies in the energy space. And it's kind of small on the map, but Cook Inlet is very well suited for this type of technology. We currently are not at a commercial development stage in this as a country. However, we are in the process of doing the rulemaking associated with what carbon storage could look like in the Outer Continental Shelf through geological means. We work on this very closely with our sister agency, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, as we continue to work on the regulations and structures of what carbon storage could mean for the state of Alaska. And in our discussions and in industry interest, Cook Inlet is the starting point most likely for the state of Alaska. So while there's renewable and conventional opportunities in Cook Inlet, there also is an opportunity on a large scale on the carbon side as well. Shifting gears to the next slide, our Office of Environment focuses on studies and environmental compliance work. We usually have anywhere between 15 and 20 studies ongoing, looking at factors of science and research that inform our decision-making process. And I bring this to attention because we have cultural and social sciences that we look at. We look at flora and fauna of the region, oceanography, and many other factors that could affect energy and mineral development. Two things in particular that I think are germane to today's discussion is we have a current study for Cook Inlet looking at the recreation and tourism elements in more of a cultural social sense of Cook Inlet and how they would be affected potentially by any sort of energy and mineral development in the planning area. We also offer and encourage public comment and feedback to shape our studies program. On an annual basis in the fall, we go out to all our stakeholders and partners and ask for their inputs of how to shape our studies and what type of areas need to be examined to make sure we're making the best informed decisions possible when it comes to energy and resource development through the leasing and plants program that we have in our program. Slide, please. On slide eight, you will see the leasing and plans operations for our program. This applies to all energy types. Currently, the only federal leases that we have operationally producing energy are in the conventional space. This is a snapshot of North Star Island in the Arctic Ocean. And our leasing and plans program oversees, regulates, and monitors the activities of those leases. Slide, please. This map shows the current federal leases, and others could be on there if other technologies and other energy resources were to pursue leases with our Bureau. On the left-hand side of the map is the blow-up of Cook Inlet. There currently are 8 leases, all held by Hillcorp in the middle part of Cook Inlet in the federal waters. And there are 3 active leases up north that Hillcorp also owns called the North Star, which was a picture previously held on the previous slide. So next slide, please. We also have a broad scope beyond Alaska because of our jurisdiction, and also because we are operating in Alaska. We are an Arctic nation, as we all know, as Alaskans, and we take an active role in the Arctic Council, predominantly from our science and research side. There are 2 major work groups in the Arctic Council where our staff here in Alaska directly contribute to research and analysis, looking at the flora and fauna and the marine environment that supports the Arctic, the Pan-Arctic across the globe. None of this would be possible without collaborations and teamwork. Next slide, please. This is a small sampling of the organizations that we work with on a routine basis, from academia to the Native community to the state government, federal government, and points in between. We are currently working to renew a memorandum of understanding between our bureau and the state of Alaska through DNR and the governor's office. And we're always looking for ways to more broadly participate and support the state of Alaska, as many of the objectives that the state pursues are parallel to what the federal government through our agency are pursuing up here with leasing for energy and mineral development purposes. Slide, please. One of the key elements of our work is proper outreach and engagement. And this slide highlights some of the major constituencies that we focus on as we do our work. Native community is very big for us, as our state is home to 42% of the tribes in the whole country, along with 100% of the Native corporations. We have a government-to-government relationship in that level. We work predominantly with coastal communities, although through our research at UAF, we do engage in Fairbanks from time to time, but the predominance of our work is in coastal Alaska. As I mentioned previously, we work very closely with the state government through many of the different departments. We enjoy an annual trip to Juneau to meet with the legislature, either virtually like we are doing today, or in person like we did for the last couple of years. Naturally, we work with our federal partners to advance development in Cook Inlet and around the state. And then industry and NGOs are really key players as we shape our decision making and we execute our mission for the state of Alaska on behalf of the federal government. Next slide, I would like to draw your attention to 2 current opportunities before I wrap up my comments. One is directly related to Cook Inlet. We are doing a supplemental environmental impact study for the most recent lease sale in Cook Inlet, lease sale 258. We have the opportunity to work with the district court here in Alaska to address opportunities to focus on environmental elements of that lease sale, and we're on track to complete that by early next year. And then second, just announced a couple weeks ago, is the 11th National Program for Oil and Gas. This is a chance for everyone in the country, industry, general public, environmental groups, everybody that wants to provide feedback to us to help us shape what the next 5 years of leasing should look like in the federal offshore. We have 27 planning areas nationwide, 16 in Alaska, as I began with. For the next about 40 days, we are taking public comments through a notice of a request for information to help shape what areas should be considered by the Secretary of Interior for leasing and which ones should be left off the table. So we would welcome all Alaskans to weigh in on that. If they have questions, to reach out to our office and work with us if there are any questions. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to present briefly at our agency. We welcome you while you're in the off session to come and meet with us again in person or anytime that we can be a resource or help to you. With that, I thank you for your time and I'm open for questions.
Great. Thank you, sir, for the presentation. I know we have a couple different folks with questions. We'll begin with Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate the presentation. It's very, very nice. I was wondering, what's your? Are you allowed to tell me your annual budget? And if I didn't miss it myself,
I did too. Mr. Kolanowski, did you catch the question?
Sir, I believe it was the annual budget. That is actually in flux right now. We do not have a final number. We are waiting for the return of funds from Washington, D.C. out there. But historically, we've been between the $7 to $10 million range for the region.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up? Okay. Representative Costello?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kokonowski. I was curious, you had mentioned your involvement with UAF, and I was glad to hear that. I imagine is your involvement with the Synergy for Energy and Power or some other entity at UAF?
Yes, ma'am. On that, we predominantly are working with the School of Fisheries and the Coastal Marine Institute, are funded through our agency partially. It's mostly on the research front. We have on-staff scientists here within our regional federal employee pool, but we also rely quite a bit on academia and other partners to conduct some of our research.
Thank you. I am curious about when you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation the addition of the high Arctic area, and that's the first, it's the map on page 2. Could you talk about the significance of naming an area high Arctic?
The planning areas below there were existing prior to this. That was the name that was selected for this. I don't know the actual naming history per se of why that name versus another name was called for that area, but it is high up in the Arctic Ocean in territory that the United States fairly recently claimed in that area.
Follow up.
So I was curious. So that area had previously been the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea. Is there any significance in terms of activity that BOEM does by having that designated as a distinct area?
Prior to that territory being added, generally the extent of the Outer Continental Shelf was the 3-mile limit out to the Exclusive Economic Zone, which is about 200 miles offshore. This area extends well beyond that into the Arctic Ocean.
Okay, I see. So this is beyond the federal areas that we currently know that you oversee.
Right. This is a new addition on this cycle of the national program.
Okay. And then finally, I wanted to – so it's my understanding that Norway is chairing the Arctic Council. Do you know when the United States is planning on having the chair of that council?
Not off the cuff, but there's 8 nations, and the last time the U.S. had it was 2015. So it takes about 16 years to come back to us. So we're about halfway back to being the chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation today.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I've got a couple questions I wanted to run by you, sir. The first one, I'd like to follow up on the leasing slide. You mentioned some of the leasing activities, and I'm curious about the leasing as it relates to other energy projects. In particular, I know on the land-based projects, we're currently looking at legislation that recognizes that the traditional methods of leasing for oil and gas on our surface hasn't necessarily served the renewable projects well. So we have a couple pieces of legislation that are being developed to understand how we would do land leasing for renewable projects. And where I'm going with this is there a similar challenge and need for us to understand the regulatory environment for leasing ocean assets for renewable projects? Are we going to run into the same problem, or does the current leasing systems that you have available, are they satisfactory for the equivalent set of renewable projects that might be in water resources? I don't know if I made sense with that question, but I didn't know that it was a problem on land, and it has been. I'm wondering if it's a challenge in water.
I understand your question, sir. We have a quite flexible leasing approach. Where there are areas of high industry demand, we are doing the national program, for example, where we narrow down areas that could be available for lease based on industry's interests. So if we have an overwhelming focus on Cook Inlet and 20 different companies want to lease federal waters to do tidal projects or oil projects in Cook Inlet, we would offer a competitive lease. We also have opportunities to do research leases. If a company wants to prove out a technology or try something, we have that avenue. We also take unsolicited requests. So if a company comes to us and we currently don't offer a lease for an area or not the type of lease they're looking for, they can approach us and we would work with them and then go through a public process of making that available if there's interest in an area so that others would have a fair shot at it. But our leasing and plans team would work with interested parties to find the right solution for what they're looking for. But I believe we have a pretty flexible process that works well for Alaska and the needs of industry and development of energy and mineral resources.
Great. Thank you for that. Shifting a little bit, there's been some work last fall through the University of Alaska Fairbanks looking at this new potential of natural sources of hydrogen. And identifying and characterizing some of the areas, which I believe include some of the zones that you've mentioned in your map offshore because of subduction activity that leads to potentially naturally occurring sources of hydrogen. And I'm curious what BOEM's strategy is around exploring and developing natural sources of hydrogen, and then, you know, complementary with that, what the strategy is as it relates to generated sources of hydrogen through ocean energy opportunities, whether it's wind or tidal. So kind of a general question about hydrogen, natural and generated.
So I'll begin, sir, with the natural hydrogen side. That is not one of our core focus areas right now because we are driven largely by industry. We are a landlord agency and a leasing agency. So unless industry wants to develop projects, we really don't have a role in the technology. We're pretty agnostic. But we are monitoring the work at UAF. Last fall when they had the Geological Hydrogen Conference, we sent one of our supervisory geologists there, and we still keep good relations with the university and stay monitoring what's happening. And should interest grow, we would work to adjust to that on the offshore. As for produced hydrogen, we certainly have been talking with some of the gentlemen testifying on this call about their interests and capabilities. And if it existed in the federal offshore, which the National Renewable Energy Lab did a study about 2 years ago looking at offshore potential of Alaska, there is capability that we would be, again, the leasing agency for such projects. And like I mentioned before, we really are agnostic, whether it's on the mineral side, the carbon side, or on the energy side. We're here to advance energy development and national security in that sense for the nation. And we would work with the industry partners that would have interest in those areas that could produce hydrogen, SAF, or any of the other products that we're here to facilitate the development in a financially responsible manner per statute and environmentally responsible manner.
Great. Thank you for that. Shifting a little bit with regard to carbon capture strategies, I was really intrigued with the map that's identifying a much broader potential area of CCUS activity than I was aware of existed in Alaska. But I'm concerned in particular about Cook Inlet that has been identified as a potential area for a significant amount of sequestration tied to some projects. What's the current strategy that BOEM has in terms of projects, both characterizing the available CCUS storage capacity, and you know, my general awareness is we've got about 5 gigatons of capacity that's pretty well established, and potentially another 45. I'm wondering how BOEM is looking at that, and what role BOEM will play in the continued characterization and development of our understanding of that potential.
So to your question, sir, we have our geologist here in the region working on this, as well as some of our headquarter counterparts. Right now, the first phase of that is to develop the framework for carbon storage in the offshore, which has begun already. It's promulgating the regulations of how the process would work and concurrently being able to understand what the resource potential is for the storage on that. But this has just started in the last couple of years. And we have preliminary understanding of what is available, but we do not have a firm program beyond just an initial phase that we're in right now.
Okay, great. And then my final question, just as kind of a wrap-up, coming back to the Cook Inlet, I'm curious if, from the perspective of the Cook Inlet work group that you mentioned at the beginning, and in light of the executive orders of unleashing our energy potential, does that work group or does BOEM have any particular priorities and areas of focus for Cook Inlet that we should be focused in on and aware of?
Well, right now, I would say, sir, that the top priority is looking at expanding the capabilities in conventional energy, and Cook Inlet is always a popular area for leasing. There's always been activity over the last several lease sales for Cook Inlet, but that does not preclude the other opportunities that we're talking about today, that BOEM is a very broad-based agency looking at mineral opportunities, which are relatively small for Cook Inlet, but also the carbon that we just talked about. So we go to where the demand is, and right now we continue to work with industry and hear what the interests are and areas where we need to study more so that we're prepared to do leasing and permitting activities, and that we have a sense of what kind of capabilities and resources we need to make available to industry and the public to properly develop these resources in a way that benefits the U.S. Treasury and also maintains the high environmental standards that our agency is known for.
Great. That's very helpful. Thanks. Are there any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Mr. Kolanowski, thank you so much for joining us today and your presentation and being here for our questions. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Our next presenter is David Clark. Mr. Clark is the engineering director for Alaska Marine Power. Mr. Clark, if you're ready, I think we have your slides up and are looking forward to your presentation.
Okay, I'd like to thank the Energy Committee for giving me the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I'll be talking about Alaska hydrogen. As Japan is one of our primary target export markets, the characters in red is the Japanese word for hydrogen, which is SUZO. So if we move to the second slide, please. The key messages that I want to discuss today is that Alaska is well positioned for the new multi-billion dollar export market for renewable energy. Alaska can be a renewable energy superpower as Asia moves away from fossil fuels. And we can export oil, LNG, and low-carbon hydrogen. We can do all three. They're not mutually exclusive. They use different resources, and they're targeting different energy markets. Alaska Marine Power, we feel that it's competitive, it's executable, and it is bankable now. We can supply low-carbon hydrogen to markets in Japan and South Korea. We can produce sustainable aviation fuel for the Anchorage Airport. And we can provide low-cost, clean energy power for Alaskans and Alaskan miners. And in the process, develop thousands of stable, high-paying jobs. The role of Alaska Marine Power is really as project developer and supply chain integrator. Slide three, please.
Mr. Clark, just a question for you. Could you, sure, for my benefit, maybe others, I'm curious about the term low-carbon hydrogen. I saw that in the presentation deck, and I wanted to ask you if you could expand on that a little bit. I can make lots of guesses about that, but I wonder if you could describe that a little more specifically in terms of what you mean by that term.
Yeah, as you'll see in one of the upcoming slides, the Japanese are not looking for pure green hydrogen. They're looking for low-carbon hydrogen, which is a carbon intensity less than 3.4 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of hydrogen. So it's about 70% green.
So just as a follow-up, then, in my vernacular, would that mean blue hydrogen would be a low-carbon hydrogen? Am I kind of in the same ballpark that you're referring to hydrogen that might come from means that may have a carbon capture sequestration in order to get the carbon intensity down? Is that what we're talking about, or am I off base?
It would depend on how the blue hydrogen is produced and whether or not they captured all the carbon dioxide from the production process. So it may or may not fall under the definition of low carbon hydrogen.
Fair enough. Did you have a question, Representative?
No, go ahead.
Okay, we may come back to this, but let's go ahead and continue on. Thank you for letting me dive into that question for a moment.
Okay. Slide three, please. This is a little bit about Alaska Marine Power. It was formed 3 years ago by myself and my colleague, Simon Harrison, with a mission to develop the significant energy resource in the Cook Inlet. We both had long careers in oil and gas with engineering and commercial experience, and we find that that's very relevant to the skills required to develop offshore wind and produce low carbon hydrogen. Slide number four, please. This is really a roadmap to the four topics that I'll cover in more detail in my presentation. First of all, we have the renewable energy resource, offshore wind and geothermal. And the resource that we have is actually orders of magnitude more than the rail belt could absorb. So we have to create a market for that renewable power, and the obvious one is to produce hydrogen. We can then export that hydrogen either as liquid hydrogen or in a carrier such as liquid ammonia to markets in Asia. As Gibby mentioned, the Japan and the U.S. Department of Energy are looking at importing CO2 for sequestration in the Cook Inlet. So if we have a supply of carbon dioxide, we can also produce a range of electrofuels, and the main one being sustainable aviation fuel, which we could supply to the Anchorage Airport. We can also use the renewable energy to electrify new and existing mines in the state to lower their environmental impact. And we can also supply as much renewable energy to the rail belt grid as they can absorb from a single source. And slide number five, please. This is a map of the Cook Inlet Wind. It was developed by NREL, as Gibby mentioned, a couple of years ago. The darker the blue, the stronger the wind. You can see that there's a tremendous offshore wind resource in the Aleutians, but it's a long way from infrastructure, and most of it's in a very deep water. So we've really been focusing on the excellent quality wind in the lower Cook Inlet, which is inside that yellow circle. What makes the wind in the lower Cook Inlet exceptional is it's got a gross capacity factor of 64%. So that means if you've got a 100 megawatt wind farm, that the average over a year, it'll produce 64 megawatts. And that's almost double the capacity factor of Fire Island. So excellent quality wind. Right. Slide number six, please.
Mr. Clark, we've got a question before you go on, please. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, you had made a statement on the previous slide that you could produce more than the rail belt can absorb. How much does the rail belt absorb right now, if any?
It's just over half a gigawatt.
Half a megawatt. And then my second question would be probably on a previous slide before that was you said that Japan and Korea were the biggest buyers. What is their primary use for it when they purchase?
Yes, I think I'll cover that question in
okay,
an upcoming
sorry.
Slide.
Thank you. I apologize.
And if I can, just to clarify the question, Representative, I think the answer was that the current rail belt uses a little over half a gigawatt, and these projects we're talking about are gigawatt level. I mean, enough that they could supply the entire rail belt a couple times over in terms of the order of magnitude here. It's a pretty dramatic additional level of energy that's being discussed here, to the point that supplying the rail belt, I think, is seen as if they want a little bit, they can have a little bit, but that's not the size of these projects are far bigger than that, but it's half a gigawatt. Representative Mears?
Thank you, Coach O'Hanlon. And I think that's part of our discussions, you know, that we've had in committee is what's that other industry that has that demand? So this type of project doesn't make sense just for local demand. This type of project makes sense when there's other demands. So how do you get cheap energy, like have a lot more demand than we do? So that's one of our chicken and egg problems.
Yeah. Very good. All right, Mr. Clark, go ahead and continue on then. Thank you.
Yes, I'm going to pull up slide number six. So this is zooming in on the lower Cook Inlet. Again, the darker the blue, the better the wind. you can see that the best wind actually is in the Lower Cook Inlet, between Mount Augustine and the Barron Islands. That little red rectangle that I've drawn has the potential to produce 10 gigawatts of offshore wind. So that's 20 times what the rail belt uses. And we'll be looking to run a 110-mile HVDC cable directly back to Dikiski. The water depth here varies somewhere between 40 and 120 meters. The NREL actually classed the wind, and you can see in the graph in the top left that we're actually in the top 1% of all U.S. offshore wind resources in terms of wind quality in the average annual wind speed. In fact, the shallow water location, which is located next to Mount Augustine, is literally off the scale. Nobody anticipated that the wind could be that strong. The wind is strong throughout the year, as you can see from the bar chart. It does drop off a little bit during the summer months. Slide number seven, please. So Alaska Hydrogen can compete. We need to develop at least half a gigawatt of power to justify that long distance transmission line. So we're looking at a first developing this in phases. The first phase would be somewhere between a half to 1 gigawatt. That would allow us to produce 50 to 100 kilotons of hydrogen per year, with the ultimate potential being at least 10 times that. But what really sets the Cook Inlet apart is great geography. We got a world-class offshore wind resource. We're close to the markets in Japan. We got a brownfield site and deep water port at Nikiski, and we got underground hydrogen storage potential. And Alaska's got a long history of exporting energy. And we got good bilateral relationships with Japan, but we got a significant deficit in our trade balance with Japan at the moment, and this project would help address that. The picture that you can see is of a offshore wind turbine installation vessel. Because we're offshore, we can bring in these big vessels so we can install large turbines. We're looking at a 15 megawatt turbine as our base case, which is about 10 times bigger than the turbines at Fire Island. Slide number eight, please.
Mr. Clark, just before going on there, I wonder if you could try and take the hydrogen production figures there and relate it to what you may know or can help us understand in terms of the demand that might exist right now in Japan and other countries for hydrogen. Is this level of production consistent with the level of demand and opportunity that these countries have, significantly higher or lower? I'm just trying to wrap my head around. I think we know that the size of the production is, as you mentioned, 20 times greater than the rail belt, but I'm trying to understand what the hydrogen production is relative to the demand by other people, other countries.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll be covering that in two slides.
Very good. Thank you. And let's continue. But I'm sorry, we've got a question from Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just wanted to know if the executive order issued by the President relative to unleashing Alaska's energy potential provides you any advantage in what you're endeavoring to do, but also in terms of unlocking the world-class geography and the Cook Inlet.
Representative Edmund, through the chair. Yes, this I think fits entirely with the administration's long-term goals to make Alaska an energy superpower.
A follow-up then?
Right, thank you again. And is that through permitting and licensing? Because I don't suspect that there's any funding attached to it or any sort of directed research, but please correct me if I'm faulty in my assumptions.
Representative Edmund, through the chair. Yes, we have the potential to produce a huge quantity of liquid hydrogen and liquid ammonia for export to Asia, and also to produce sustainable aviation fuel for the airport. And as you'll see in an upcoming slide, the Japanese are prepared to pay a premium for those green products.
A follow-up?
Yes, I'm just going to assume that my questions are going to go unanswered because they may not be answerable, but I appreciate the intent behind your message. Thank you.
Thank you. Slide number eight. Just delving into the global hydrogen market, Europe will import low-carbon hydrogen. This is a schematic of the NEOM project in Saudi Arabia. They will use onshore wind and solar to produce 200,000 tons of hydrogen a year, and that'll be exported as liquid ammonia to markets in Europe. This is an $8.4 billion project. Slide number nine. Japan also wants to import low-carbon hydrogen. The Japanese government passed a groundbreaking Hydrogen Society Promotion Act last October. They want to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 60% by 2035 and promote long-term economic growth. And the way they're planning to do that is using a contract for difference subsidy, which was pioneered in the UK for offshore wind. And they will actually pay the difference between the production cost of green hydrogen and grey hydrogen for a period of 15 years. So this allows early movers to get financing. It's a much more flexible mechanism than straight subsidies. And the Japanese are being really pragmatic. As I mentioned before, they're not looking for pure green hydrogen. They're looking for low-carbon hydrogen, which is about 70% green, as long as it meets that carbon intensity threshold. So I'm not sure whether blue hydrogen produced from natural gas would meet that threshold. It really depends on the system that they use. And the Japanese are looking to produce 12 million tons per year by 2040. So that gives you an idea of there's a huge market. Even if we develop all the wind in the Cook Inlet, we're talking about a million tons a year. So it'd be a relatively small percentage of what Japan is looking for.
Mr. Clark, with that in mind, do you have some projection of whether or not the global supplies are already in place and developed to meet this demand by Japan, or is this a projected demand that currently has a known or measurable gap that we would be potentially producing into?
Mr. Chair, this is there is a major gap at the moment. I think the next slide, number 10, partly addresses that.
Yeah, go ahead then. It seems like I'm always one slide behind. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Australia is already hard at work. We would see them as our main competitor. They're currently appraising at least half a dozen projects. I've given details of three of them here in yellow, and the blue is what we're looking at in Alaska. So all the projects are looking to be developed in phases. That's one nice thing, is you don't have to develop it all at once. The big difference between the Australian projects and Alaska is that they're all looking at onshore wind and solar, whereas we're looking at offshore wind and potentially geothermal. All the projects plan to export hydrogen, both as liquid hydrogen and as ammonia. We have a big advantage over Australia in that we're significantly closer to those Asian markets, particularly to the projects in Western Australia. And AMP is marketing Alaska hydrogen to Japanese off-takers as we speak. And slide 11. Oh, did that address your question that you had?
Thank you, sir. I think it did, although I'm learning that I just need to let you finish your presentation. I'm getting a little over-enthusiastic with some of my questions.
No problem. Slide number 11, sustainable aviation fuel. Airlines will have to transition to a SAF on international routes. All the major airlines flying into Anchorage Airport have pretty ambitious targets for SAF production or SAF use. Anchorage International Airport options are they can import SAF. Question is from where, as demand is likely to exceed supply. Or they can refine it from Alaskan fats, basically fish waste and or woody biomass. But there's a limited volume of both of those, and both of those pathways to SAF are logistically challenging. But we could make it from Alaska hydrogen and from imported CO2. And Alaska, the Cook Inlet, has potential to supply over 100% of Anchorage Airport's kerosene needs. So the next step is AMP has partnered with a global SAF specialist And there's ongoing discussions with the Alaska Department of Transport are looking at options for supplying SAF to the airport. Slide number 12. You can also look at hard rock mining. International miners are under pressure to reduce their environmental impacts. In fact, just this weekend, there was an article in the ADN where Kinross are looking for more renewable energy to reduce their emissions. So the options for new mines, they can either go to the traditional fossil fuel use with diesel and natural gas, but that results in high emissions. There is a spill risk from diesel, and the cost of can be quite volatile. Right, with modern electric mines, you have an electric transmission line to power the mine equipment, but it can also power the dump trucks. That power could come from a power plant with CCUS or from Cook Inlet renewable energy. So I think the next steps are joint studies with some of the Alaskan mine developers to see how we can electrify their mines using Cook Inlet renewable power and reduce their overall emissions. Slide 13. This is really just a wrap up. Alaska can become a renewable energy superpower, and the Alaskan Hydrogen Project can serve multiple internal and export markets. And our final slide, number 14. This is the last slide that we presented at the Japan Arctic Symposium. Alaska can supply low carbon hydrogen to Japan. So let's get to work.
Great. Thank
you. Very, very happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Yeah, first question from Representative Mears or Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you so much, Mr. Clark, for sharing with us. It's exciting to think about the possibilities. Since we were just talking about mining towards the end there, I can't remember if we talked about it so much in committee, but I've had other meetings at least where it seems like there's a lot of development and electrification of equipment for mining. So it's not just the processing of the ore, but the equipment itself. There's a lot of momentum for using electricity rather than diesel for running equipment. Is that something you're experiencing or hearing as well?
Yes, a lot of the, Madam Chair, a lot of the new mines internationally are highly electrified for the mine processing equipment. But also the dump trucks can actually run on overhead power lines with a pantograph, similar to an electric train, and the drag lines are quite often electrified as well. So they can significantly reduce diesel use by up to 70%. So in Alaska's case, that's a lot, significantly reduces the spill risk of importing diesel in by barge up rivers.
Yeah. So following up on that, it's not only the desire for, you'd mentioned Kinross looking to do some decarbonization. So it's not only that goal, but a lot of mining sites are a bit more remote. So reducing diesel is reducing those, that supply chain and that cost by having something that, electricity you can generate on site and have a little bit more control over.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Representative Costello?
Thank you. My question has to do with making the transition from jet fuel to some other type of aviation fuel. Do you know what the cost associated with that might be? And then also at the destination, you would have to have that also. Is that something you'll be getting information on through that study that I saw in here, or do you happen to know?
Yeah, I believe the Alaska Department of Transport are looking at that in their study for Anchorage Airport. So initially they would start off with maybe a blend of maybe 10 to 20% of SAF and the rest is normal kerosene. And then over time we see that blend, the percentage of SAF increasing. Most of the airlines have pretty ambitious targets to blend SAF with their kerosene. And in fact, it's mandated in Europe that they have to meet certain percentages by certain dates. That's not the case in the U.S. at the moment, but possibly, I think the airlines will drive that. So it's very important that Anchorage Airport has the ability to supply as much sustainable aviation fuel as the airlines require. The cargo airlines are a little bit less price sensitive maybe than the passenger airlines, but this is it's a very strong trend that we're seeing.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Co-Chair Mears?
Thank you, Chair Holland. Mr. Clark, so what's holding us back? Is it market maturity, technology maturity, regulations, investment environment, a combination of a lot of things?
Unlike developing a wind farm on the east or west coast where you have thousands of customers, we really have to get a customer in place before we can actually justify building the wind farm and all the other infrastructure. So that's kind of why we're working with the Japanese to develop that market. And we really need to have a Japanese partner to work with to be able to go for that contract for difference scheme that the Japanese have now to import low carbon hydrogen. So it's all about market. It's getting the market first, and then we'll work backwards to supply the energy that they need.
Mr. Clark, do you see that there's either barriers that the state has or ways that we can support that happening?
There is a current pause on the leasing of new wind farms. We hope that's a temporary bump in the road. But I think that a wind farm, the Lower Cook Inlet, doesn't have a lot of the objections that you would have if you were building it on the East Coast. It's not in anyone's viewshed. It's actually serving the export market. So it, I think it's compatible with a lot of the objectives of the current administration.
Through the chair, so that's more of a federal barrier at this point than a state barrier. But of course, we always send messages to the feds on things that would be supportive of Alaska development.
Madam Chair, so we met with the Kenai Peninsula Borough a week before last, and they are very, very pro-development, and I think that that is something that maybe we wouldn't find in other states. So Nikiski is a great site for production of hydrogen. And as I say, it's got unique geology. It's got everything we need to move this project forward.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Page 13, Alaska is well positioned for the new multi-billion dollar export market for renewable energy, can be a renewable energy superpower as Asia moves away from fossil fuels, can export oil, LNG, low carbon hydrogen. So my question here, why are we so different? And why are we the answer for Asia?
I think number one is location, the quality of our renewable energy resources, and we're in a pro-development state.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I kind of thought maybe it was a geographical trifecta of some sort, which positions us to have the most dynamic wind current on the planet. I don't know. I was just looking for something like that. Is there anything like that in it? I mean, or can they do it themselves with enough wind in Asia? Or is there no way? I'm just trying to figure out why we're the key.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, the Japanese are actually building some wind farms, but they have nowhere near the resources that we have here in Alaska, because not only do we have offshore wind, we have geothermal, we may have tidal in the future. So in the Cook Inlet, NREL estimated there's up to 90 gigawatts of potential power. So having that in close to infrastructure is really, really valuable. A lot of the projects in Australia are in very, very remote areas without the infrastructure. So we have got a lot of advantages here in Alaska. that other countries don't have.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So, Mr. Clark, a couple questions I wanted to ask you about. I think, I'm sorry, I'm just kind of looking at which order I want to take the three of them. I think I'm just going to kind of back up. First off, in terms of the significance of this resource development and export opportunity, when we traditionally think of Alaska exporting energy, we think of it in terms of rents and royalties and other ways we derive some significant income. What's your view of how we should be viewing the projects you're talking about, the size of the projects, and what does that mean for Alaska as we think about the value to Alaska and to the state economically?
Mr. Chair, these exports will actually produce thousands of jobs, high-paying jobs. There will also be revenue from the offshore wind farm leasing, but you're talking about several multi-billion-dollar plants that would be located at Nikiski, so there would be a significant public tax coming in from those projects.
Great, thanks. Representative Costello?
Thank you. So, however, there is no royalty that the state is receiving from wind farms. I mean, could you talk about any benefit to the state in that regard?
It won't be as lucrative. Representative Costello, through the chair, it won't be as lucrative as oil and gas developments because the margins are less for renewable energy. But there will be significant revenues. We haven't actually worked out numbers yet on what the financial benefit would be to the state, but it's likely to be significant.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I want to go back to a question I asked earlier in the other presentation related to the challenges that we've seen exist on land-based leasing, providing access for renewable projects. And I'm wondering from your perspective, do the leasing programs and terms for water-based, ocean leasing projects, are they developed and satisfactory to support the kind of projects you're developing? Or do we have the same gap in our statutory and regulatory framework that we see in land-based projects in our water and potentially state waters, that we should be recognizing that we have some work to do in that area? Or is everything, do you have everything you need from the standpoint of the leasing programs and terms?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we have everything we need. The wind farm will be 100% located within in federal waters, so it'll come under BOEM. As I say, there is a hiccup in the road at the moment with the pause on federal leasing, but we expect that to be temporary.
Great, thank you. And then the last question I've got backing finally up to the financing of the projects. We, of course, know that with the current large gas projects lining up financing and having those ship or pay contracts in place becomes a major challenge. And barrier, is it the same magnitude of challenge that you're facing trying to line up and go through the process we see in the press, quite frankly, right now about trying to line up buyers and those commitments? Are you in the same challenge, and are we competing against ourselves, or is this project and the size and scope make it easier or harder to line up those firm commitments that you need in order to be able to secure the financing for the projects?
Mr. Chair, I think it's easier than a large LNG project because all the projects around the world are actually developed in phases. So we can start small and then grow the business. So we took maybe about a first phase around the $5 billion mark and then grow it from there. And the new Japanese hydrogen promotion law actually guarantees the difference in the price between the green hydrogen and the gray hydrogen for a period of 15 years. So that is very, very helpful for getting financing for the project because you've got a locked-in price for 15 years.
That's helpful. Mr. Clark, just a clarification. Did I catch that you're looking at your first phase project being roughly a $5 billion project? Did I hear that correctly?
Of that order of magnitude, yes.
That's fine. Thank you for clarification. Are there any other questions about this particular project or for Mr. Clark on the work that he and his team are doing? Wonderful. Well, this has, again, been really helpful, Mr. Clark, to provide some clarification on your project, but also to see the significance of the size and scale of the work that you're envisioning doing. I would invite you, you know, as we move ahead to let us know if there's other work that we should or could be doing that would be able to identify barriers that would be helpful to your project down the road. But thank you for your time today.
Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak this afternoon.
Great, thank you. So our next presenter now is Mr. Anthony Panino. He is with the Board of Directors with GEO Alaska. Mr. Panino, you can begin your presentation. I believe we have the first slide up here, so we're ready to go on our end.
Yes, and I just want to give the opportunity to thank the committee for allowing us this opportunity to present on this very exciting project. So first slide there is just showing that's a photo of Mount Augustine from the east. And if you go to the next slide, please. The next slide gives a general area and location of Mount Augustine, Lower Cook Inlet, about 62 miles southwest of Anchor Point, which is basically the closest connection to the existing rail belt grid. And as you can see from that photo on the left, the green area is shown the original acreage that GEO Alaska obtained back in 2022. And the orange acreage is actually the new leases that we were the apparent high bidder on in the most recent acreage lease sale at Augustine just this last month. So this is an update. So the data that I'll be presenting for this presentation is primarily obviously focused on the green area, which is our previous existing lease acreage, but we're very excited about that we were successful in the additional acreage that's shown in orange on that slide as well. Next slide, please.
Just if you could, proceeding on, just a quick question on that. Could you clarify whether these are federal or state leases?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, these are all state leases. Augustine Island is 100% on state lands.
Great. Thank you for the clarification.
No problem. Next slide, please. This slide shows a summary of we've done 2 years of basically subsurface analysis work, MT surveys, which are analogous to like a seismic survey that you do for an oil and gas project. We go out there in the summer, we put active probes in, and it gives us an understanding of the subsurface geology and what the traditional geothermal perspective prospect looks like out at Augustine Island. So based on this, basically, we did a survey of the entire southern part of the island. The figure on the upper left of the project shows those potential attractive traditional geothermal resources that have been identified through the surveys. And that big red bulge that you see there, like right in the middle, is actually the magma chamber at Augustine Island. Augustine Island is probably the most studied volcano in the United States, primarily due to potential eruption events around aviation safety. So AVO, USGS, DGGS has been studying Augustine for decades, and the shallow magma chamber was always understood as part of the geology at Augustine, but we were the first people to actually go out there and actually do active surveys to show the existence and the extent of that magma chamber. So as you can see on the left there, that's in meters. So that magma chamber is, right around 5,000 feet below sea level or below the surface. It's one of the shallowest magma chambers actually on the planet. And for a reference, Mount Spur, right across Cook Inlet from us, is the magma chamber is around 20,000 feet. So this existence of the shallow magma chamber is very attractive from a traditional geothermal perspective in terms of hot rock, hot water, that a traditional geothermal project would develop. And then also the potential, I'll go through in some other slides, of actually getting closer to that magma chamber where you have even hotter rock that gives you the potential for a higher amount of power and electricity that could be produced. Based on this data, there's a table there on the bottom left. Basically, our P50, we had a third-party engineering company, engineering and geology company, look at the data and give us some power projections. Our P50 for exportable power from this traditional geothermal play is around 204 megawatts. So getting back to, you know, the entire grid being a little bit north of 500 megawatts, you know, that's it's a pretty big chunk of what the existing grid is right now. Next slide, please. Getting back to the shallow magma chamber, this is a slide that was developed by Dr. John Eichelberger, who's a former or professor emeritus at UAF. He's a volcanologist. He's been studying Augustine for a really long time and also studying magmatic work in Iceland. And there is this convention that if you could tap close to the magma reservoir, that basically you would get 10x the amount of power than you would out of a traditional geothermal system. Then instead of looking at like 200 megawatts, 300 megawatts, you're looking into the gigawatt scale of power. And this is obviously an untested technology at this point, but they have been doing a lot of work in Iceland around this sort of technology. And this is something that's of great interest to us and quite frankly of great interest to the state of Alaska from the standpoint of that this could be a reproducible technology that could be used at other locations, both in Alaska and basically on a global perspective. So this could be something, you know, not just for the benefits of the residents of the state of Alaska, which is obviously what we're most interested in, but quite frankly, from a global perspective, this could be a very interesting, you know, technology advancement that we could potentially look at Augustine. Next slide, please. So potential uses of baseload geothermal power. I know David Clark went through a lot of these in the previous presentation, but I'll just go through some of them right now. Obviously, you know, this is baseload low carbon power. So you're talking about 96% runtime, similar to a natural gas fired power plant, for example, in terms of reliability. So it's not an intermittent power. There's a geothermal plant in Italy that was built in 1904 that is still operating right now. So the lifespan of these projects can be quite long. It's somewhat of a renewable infinite resource, quite frankly. So obviously, you know, we have issues with natural gas shortages in Cook Inlet, you know, displacing higher carbon sources such as coal and natural gas. And I apologize that this is kind of a remnant of previous presentations. I quoted the state of Alaska's 80% RPS goals, and I understand that those were originally brought a couple years ago. And I know that you guys are exploring, I think, a 55% by 2035 and HB 153. So I just wanted to clarify that as an error that was made in this presentation. We're looking at a lot of potential uses for potential excess power production on the island. Data centers is a huge one. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with data centers. By 2030, they're going to be using 12% of electricity in the United States. There's a massive need for data centers, specifically from power production. And the key value with geothermal, it's the value of decarbonized electricity in terms of helping potential commercial customers reach net zero goals is very attractive. Running data centers, green fuels, a lot of discussions around SAF, you know, Anchorage International Airport, fourth busiest cargo airport in the world. They use 2 million gallons of jet fuel a day, and most of that is actually imported from Asia. So there's a huge marketplace right in our backyard, basically, for this excess power that can be produced. And then obviously direct support of other high-end power users, whether those are industrial facilities, mines, refineries, people who have a lot of need for electricity at a baseload level that's also been decarbonized. Next slide, please.
Great. We've got a question before you continue on. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland, through the chair. So getting back to the desire for low-carbon energy sources, I just kind of wanted to highlight that because I've heard from other places that, like, tech for data centers is looking for utilization of lower carbon sources like renewables. So it sounds like you're having that experience as well, and it's not just in tech. And we discussed in the last presentation with Mr. Clark of the mining industry also looking to be lower carbon. So you're finding in your market research that that is a desirable source of energy.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. Yes. For example, just using tech as an example, you probably hear the term net zero bandied around quite a bit. Most companies that are net zero through scope 2 and scope 3, primarily buying carbon credits, buying offsets, for example. But now tech companies want to be scope 1 net zero, which means their actual emission profile, they're trying to work to a scope, a net zero emission strategy. So being able to provide data centers, for example, that have, you know, a very low carbon footprint, such as geothermal would be very attractive outside of a traditional data center. Most of the data centers in the United States, for example, are obviously in the lower 48. They're in areas where they primarily use coal and natural gas for electricity that's not been decarbonized. So having this value added electricity is very attractive to potential customers.
Follow up, yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, I've heard that too, that there's either delayed decommissioning or recommissioning of natural gas and coal because there's such a high demand for energy, and that's infrastructure that is already existing. And I think there's also, I've heard of utilizing those facilities for brownfields development for renewables because there's already the electricity transmission infrastructure in place. So even if they are transitioning the fuels, doing sort of a brownfields development for that is highly desirable because there's already existing infrastructure.
Yeah, yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. There's a lot of moving and shaking going down in the lower 48 in regards to all of those types of developments.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for that. Let's continue on.
Okay, next slide. I mentioned this in the previous slide, but some of the positive commercial attributes for this key, you know, it's the baseload green electricity or power. And when I talk about geothermal power, it may not necessarily just be the electricity that's produced, but the associated steam and heat that's produced can also be have some engineering qualities to it under certain circumstances. So geothermal is, you know, not all green energy projects are the same. I'll just put it that way. They all have their unique qualities. So obviously, you know, hooking into the grid, you know, for the public's use or commercial users, you know, you typically get a PPA, power purchase agreement. So you have that aspect in terms of a revenue for a project like you would at a geothermal project at Augustine Island. The Inflation Reduction Act has something called the investment tax credit, which is actually a monetizable credit. So it's actually a check from Treasury that you get. And that is in the neighborhood, and it varies based on your projects and based on some metrics, but it can be around 30% of your CapEx or your capital expenditures can be basically rebated back from the Treasury as under the IRA. So that's obviously very attractive for these sort of projects. And then a really big one is actually the monetization of the environmental attributes. So the environmental attributes associated with lower carbon sources of electricity can be it can be done in a various ways of functions. One are renewable energy certificates or RECs. That, for example, is how Chugach Electric monetizes the environmental attributes at Fire Island. They get a certain percentage per kilowatt hour back with these RECs. But another one that we find very attractive is actually carbon offsets in the commercial marketplace. So that would be a commercial agreement between ourselves and someone in industry who's trying to offset their carbon footprint by basically purchasing our carbon offsets in a financial transaction. So those are all very attractive commercial attributes for a geothermal project such as at Augustine. Next slide, please. So this shows somewhat of a general perspective in terms of a time frame. So if you go from the left to the right, obviously, so GeoAlaska was formed in 2020. It's based in Anchorage. The CEO is based in Anchorage. I'm based in Anchorage. We have some other investors in the lower 48, but we are primarily owned and operated by local Anchorage residents. So we got our permits, our original permits back in 2022. We did two summers of data collection. We additional Augustine permits in 2025. And right now we're trying to raise money to drill a well out at Augustine to basically prove up the reservoir. And then after that, we will do another capital raise to basically build up the project. And the nice thing about Augustine Island, strictly from a development perspective, it's 100% on state lands. It's uninhabited. There's really no flora or fauna out there. There's some non-native foxes and voles. There's no wetlands. There's no bodies of water. There's some ephemeral streams from snowmelt. And another very attractive thing is it's down near Homer. It's kind of in the banana belt of Cook Inlet. You can drill year round down there. You don't have the same seasonal drilling restrictions like you do, for example, on the North Slope or at places with higher elevation where you have snow concerns. So actually the location of Augustine, we think, is very attractive, strictly from a project development perspective and also from a permitting perspective as well. Next slide, please. So just in conclusion, you know, this is just going through a lot of the points that I've already made before, but just, you know, like we have high electricity rates in Alaska, specifically in the winter. So when you have places like Texas, where you have a lot of wind and solar, they obviously use more electricity in the summer because of air conditioning. When they obviously get more sun for solar, we use more electricity in the winter because it's cold. So obviously we get less solar in the winter because we get less sunlight. So things like that make a baseload renewable power source more attractive in a place like Alaska than it may be in the lower 48. Obviously helping to decarbonize the grid with carbon offsets. And, you know, we're looking at this conventional geothermal resource as well as this basically world-class shallow magma play that potentially could be a, you know, a global game changer in terms of looking at the technology there. We think we have a lot of opportunities for on-island usage of baseload green power as well. Went through a lot of those with you already. And the location, you know, of Augustine, you know, we're obviously not on the grid, but we're within a distance that is attractive for connecting to the grid. And that's it.
Great.
Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to present.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. I know we've got a few questions lined up, and I apologize. I let you get ahead one slide. I was supposed to catch you, and then I got distracted writing down a question and didn't ask you to back up one slide to the timeline. I know Representative Rauscher had a question on that slide. Sorry, I let that one get away from me.
It's good. I appreciate it, through the chair. So, through the chair, you went through your timeline, and I noticed you went from add Augustine permits to raise capital, and there's the power purchase agreements in between there. And you didn't mention power purchase agreements in your timeline. So I'm wondering, do you have to get through PPA to get to first capital raise? Or can you bypass that? Are you bypassing it? Or do you have power purchase agreements already online?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. Yes. So we have looked at that's a very good question. You know, we've looked at we've talked to several utilities in the state of Alaska. They're very excited about this project and excited about the potential for entering a PPA with us. At this point, it's premature for us to come in to an actual executable PPA because there's too many unknowns. We don't know how much power we're going to be able to produce up there. We don't. There's just a lot of variables that we haven't been able to identify yet. But what we are working with several utilities as well as several other private potential electricity users in the region are kind of concepts of market. Like yes, we could use this electricity if it was brought to market without the specifics that a PPA actually has, because it would be premature at this time in the schedule of our project to actually say, yes, we can sell you 70 megawatts of power at X per kilowatt hour. We just don't have that level of clarity yet on what the project would look like.
You follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
So my understanding of what you just said is you are at raising capital level right now. Is that what you said?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ross. Yes, we are currently in what we call our Series A raise right now to raise money to drill the well.
Do you have a number, through the chair, do you have a number that you could give us on the amount that you're trying to raise?
Through the chair, Representative Rouser. Yeah, it's in the, I would say, the $8 to $10 million range.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. Other questions? I know I've got a couple, but I want to open it up. Did you have Coach Ramirez? Go ahead.
We can go back and forth.
There we go.
Thank you, through the chair. Sorry if I missed it, but what is your sort of critical mass of size that you're looking forward to move forward?
Yeah. Yes, Madam Chair. I would say, you know, the minimum that we've modeled is around 70 megawatts, I would say, in size. Like, that's kind of the number that we've settled on in terms of it has to be at least that size. And we're fairly confident that we're going to be much greater than that. But that just internally has been our number that we've used as an internal benchmark, basically, for a low threshold.
And on the upper end?
Madam Chair, the upper end is basically there is no upper end. We think that we can utilize any excess power within the state of Alaska through the benefits for the residents of the state of Alaska, whether that's through putting power into the grid, you know, sustainable aviation fuel for the airport, data centers that would, you know, hire Alaskan residents to work there, things of that nature. For an example, you know that Iceland has a lot of geothermal and hydroelectric power. They produce 8 times as much electricity as the residents of the state use because they were able to identify industries that they could help support with all this excess power. So we think having excess power is actually a good problem to have because it'll just open us up for more potential opportunities to help monetize that power and bring benefit to the state of Alaska.
Agreed.
Well, if I can follow up on that, I'm just wondering how you view getting to the investment agreements that you need. I assume there's some sort of power purchase agreements, given the uncertainty that we have in the Cook Inlet region right now around all the various projects and efforts to try and address what is clearly a concern about an energy shortage. But with all these different activities, I imagine it's got to be challenging to find investment without having some industry demand established or uncertainty around projects that may or may not be moving ahead. How are you navigating that, and how could we bring in some way some greater clarity or assurance that would improve your ability to move the project forward and stabilize the energy need and confidence in being able to make this an investable project? Is there anything we can be doing, or how do you view the landscape and the uncertainty helping you or hurting you?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's a good question. Yeah, the investment landscape in terms specifically just looking at the Series A raise has been somewhat difficult, quite frankly, recently. Just there's obviously a lot of global financial uncertainty on a global perspective, not considering obviously the energy uncertainty within Cook Inlet. And myself as a 50 plus resident of the Cook Inlet region, I've seen all of the ups and downs of the issues in Cook Inlet. But we feel that, you know, we are going to have markets that are going to exist, whether that's connecting a combination of providing power to the grid providing power to industry users directly, providing power to, you know, on-island usage of power, and then some export, you know, maybe instead of, you know, we can export electrons, but we can also export ones and zeros through a data center. You know, there's multiple ways that we can monetize the power out there. And we feel confident once we get the well drilled and we have better confidence in what we actually have out there in terms of a resource, that the funding going forward hopefully will be fairly smooth. It's like anything else with oil and gas. The first dollar is always the hardest dollar to get because there's more uncertainty associated with it. Once you have the project and the resource more defined and you have a lot of the risk reduced associated with the project, it's easier to get funding down the road.
Great. Thank you. And following up on that, the state of Alaska, and I'm thinking, you know, obviously of ADA, has programs available for funding energy and other economic development projects. Do we have the programs available for energy projects like yours that align with your kind of project and where you're at with the funding that you're looking for?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any program that we could utilize within the state to help with funding at this phase of our project. I can't go into any specific details, but I know we've looked and we've asked people to, you know, kind of think about what we could approach the state with in terms of funding mechanisms. Anything that you would have, obviously, to suggest to us, we'd be more than happy to discuss in more detail.
Great, thanks. And then kind of going sideways from that question, you're really, as I understand the project, presenting an opportunity that has two separate aspects to it. One is the energy development project and harnessing the geothermal resources for production of power. But then there's the demand side of developing projects that might utilize that energy, whether it's for aviation fuel or export activities. Do you see yourself in a position where you have to be developing both simultaneously, you know, developing the demand side of this as well as the supply? Or is there a different set of partners or perhaps a structure by which other energy development projects might work together to develop the fuel production system, for example? How do you view the challenge of helping develop the projects and the financing on the demand side for use of the energy?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. I'll reiterate what I've said before. Once we have a better understanding of our resource after we drill a well, we'll have a better understanding of, you know, the potential for power production. And then once we get to that point, then we can start reaching out to potential demand users. And we want to be somewhat agnostic in terms of what the power is provided to, just from a financial perspective, what makes the most sense. And, you know, they'll all have, you know, pros and cons in terms of development timelines. But for us, we feel fairly confident, primarily because of the location of Augustine Island and the relative ease of potentially building the power production and drilling the wells, that we can, you know, be producing electricity and power within 3 to 4 years once we start going down that path. So a lot of it will have to do with timelines, and that timeline may not fit in, for example, of an interconnect between ourselves and the grid. So the timeline might be, hey, we want to use a bunch of power on the island to do something. And then if someone wants to build an interconnect to us, or if we want to build an interconnect out, it's going to be a sort of a juggling match in terms of how to coordinate timelines versus potential users and customers. So we are thinking about those things right now. We just don't have all of the requisite information and data to basically start making those specific commercial decisions at this point.
Okay, that's helpful, because I think you've also partially answered my question about the interrelationship of the high voltage DC interconnect between the peninsula and the rest of our grid up to Beluga. And it sounds like the modeling of the ability to supply power depends a little bit on how much you supply and where it's going to be used and whether or not those are mutually dependent upon one another or not. So that's helpful. Are there any other questions about this particular project right now and for Ms. Benino?
Okay. I wouldn't ask them.
I'm sorry?
You went and asked him already.
I went and asked him already. Well, that's good. Well, thank you for the time to prepare and to provide this presentation today. It's been very interesting and very helpful, and I'm looking forward to updates in the future of how the project moves along. It's another piece of the puzzle of particularly Cook Inlet energy options. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Great. Our final presenter is going to be Keith Meyer. Mr. Meyer is an advisor for Alaska with highly innovative fuels. Mr. Meyer, if you are ready, just 1 second, we're getting your slides up. And it looks like we have your first slide up now, so we're ready if you are. Thank you.
All right, I'm ready. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present. The company is HIF Global. We also say HIF Global. Highly innovative fuels, as you said. The company is focused on low-carbon liquid fuels. Some significant investors in the company include Porsche, Baker Hughes, EIG Capital. And then this past year, 2024, we've added three significant Japanese entities. Idemitsu is one, which is a large refining organization in Japan. They also provide quite a bit of the jet fuel to Alaska. MOL is a Japanese shipping company. And then JOGMEC is a government-funded entity that focuses on resources for Japan.
Great. Mr. Meyer, if you wouldn't mind, I think I went a little too fast at the beginning. If you wouldn't mind just clearly putting your name and your affiliation on the record for us, please.
All right. Sorry. The name is Keith Meyer, and I'm the advisor for HIF Global. My focus is looking at Alaska and hopefully developing a project, an e-fuels project in Alaska.
Great. Thank you for the clarification. Sorry for the interruption. I should have gotten that clear to begin with. Go ahead and continue, please.
The company has a number of projects going worldwide. A large one in Texas, Matagorda County, Texas. Another one in Uruguay. And then some flags planted elsewhere around the world. Next page, slide, this would be slide 3. And I may have skipped a slide there, but slide 3 is a photograph of a windmill.
Yeah, we've got it up. Thanks.
Okay, good. And then, so this is a demonstration facility built in southern Chile. This facility turns wind and CO2 into gasoline. The gasoline is molecularly identical to the gasoline you buy at a gas station. Porsche sent 5 911s down to southern Chile, had them fueled up with this gasoline, drove them around, put a YouTube crew in. It works just fine. Porsche currently buys all of the gasoline from this facility. Next page. And you folks are all welcome to come and tour that facility. It's had over 1,000 visitors from all over the world to come and see really one of the world's first e-fuels facilities. So next page,
just
slide
second,
4.
Before continuing on, I have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you guys reimburse us for...
No, sorry.
For tours sorry. Of... okay. Just thought I'd ask.
Tickets are free, but you have to get there yourself. Oh. And it is southern Chile.
I see that.
One of the reasons for southern Chile is the wind profile. And it's the same reason that Alaska is attractive. That bottom and the top of the globe have very strong winds, so that makes it attractive for wind power. So the page in front of you now is really just different events that Porsche has around the world where they take this fuel and fuel the vehicles for those events. Let's go to the next page, slide 5. I'm not going to repeat what Mr. Clark said. He did a good job there. I agree with most of what he said. This just shows the process. It really starts with renewable power to make green hydrogen through electrolysis. So just a little clarification on the color labels of hydrogen. To get green hydrogen, you need to use renewable power. to make blue, what they call blue hydrogen, you can use natural gas, but you must sequester the CO2. And then gray hydrogen is made with natural gas, but with no sequestration. And so a lot of the e-fuels project to get that e-designation, it's green, starts with green hydrogen, combines that with CO2. Ideally, the CO2 is a biogenic CO2 made without fossil fuels. So that's made from wood waste or directly captured from the air. But that CO2 and the hydrogen together makes methanol. Now you've got an exportable product. And so I view this really as the way to export Alaska's wind. Methanol is going to be used by the large shipping companies directly as a fuel. But then the methanol is also able to be transformed into the gasoline or the sustainable aviation fuel or diesel fuel. One of the things HIF is doing now is really looking at the synergies with an existing refinery to take methanol and convert that to ESAF or to gasoline. Much of the effort that HIF has spent over the last several years has really been on the cost reduction of the capital and the evaluation of vendors for the different blocks of equipment needed to produce this, because financing is a key matter. Next page, page 6, looks at Alaska's renewable options. So Alaska is blessed with many. The wind profile in the upper left there, as I indicated, is amongst the best in the country and even in the planet. As Mr. Clark pointed out, too, that offshore wind in Cook Inlet is beautiful, but really all along Alaska's coast and even some of the interior areas, wind is very good. The problem with wind is it is intermittent. So David Clark indicated offshore wind, maybe a 64% capacity factor. Onshore, as we looked at some of the key areas, you get about a 47%. That's still intermittent. And so when you've got these multi-billion dollar facilities, they like to have consistent power. One of the interesting aspects in Alaska, that middle upper picture, is pumped hydro. That allows you to take excess wind and pump water into a reservoir and then draw down when the wind is lax. In Texas, there's lots of wind power, lots of solar. Projects are able to overbuy wind and then sell it into the grid. Alaska does not have that advantage because the demand is so small. So we're really looking at, you know, wind and how to address the intermittency. Pumped hydro is one. There's also a biomass resource that I'm quite high on in Alaska. Alaska has a lot of biomass that's really wood waste. And biomass makes two things: renewable power that's dispatchable, but it also produces biogenic CO2. So it's attractive. I'm putting quite a bit of focus on that lately, and I'm pretty excited about that. Below, you've got the offshore wind. You've got geothermal, which is very exciting because that's very, very consistent. And then hydrokinetic, also very predictable. Next page, page 7. Product markets. Alaska has some good product markets. Alaska's main market really is an export market, and Asia has the advantage, or at least Alaska has an advantage serving Asia. But that airport, that SAF market, that sustainable aviation market, is very strong, and that's something we can do in Alaska. That middle picture in the bottom shows the air traffic routes. They all stop, most of the cargo routes stop in Alaska. And the reason is the limiting factor on a cargo airplane is what they call maximum takeoff weight. You can only have so much weight in a plane. And so if the airplanes can shed fuel weight, they can replace that with cargo weight. So no matter how efficient the planes get, there's always an argument for the cargo planes to stop at Alaska. So with Alaska being the fourth largest cargo airport in the world, significant jet fuel demand, It's an excellent opportunity to make the SAF, make the aviation fuel here with renewable power, a renewable fuel, and put that into the airport. I think Mr. Clark mentioned Europe's got some minimum standards now for SAF blending that increases over time. And so to me, it's not beyond the realm of possibility to have an Alaska requirement if we can make the fuel here. Next page, slide 8. Just highlights the unique aviation and marine potential. I've got a few clippings from on the right-hand side from Alaska. So the state is looking at this SAF project, you know, a SAF initiative targeting 150 million gallons a year. That's a nice size target. It's also one of the founders of the Alaska to Northwest Green Corridor Project, which really looks at reducing the carbon of the marine traffic from really Washington and now down to California, up to Alaska. On the left, I've got a number of HIF press releases. The one at the top, HIF just got their SAF pathway approved by CARB, the California Air Resources Board, first in the country to do that. Middle one, an announcement with Mabanaft, which is a major marine fuel provider, signed an agreement with HIF for the marine fuels. And then bottom one, the direct air capture. So Volkswagen Porsche, Volkswagen's the owner of Porsche, has a technology for direct air capture. You see Alaska also has an initiative that really is led by ASRC to look at direct air capture. That's sort of the holy grail of carbon capture. Porsche is putting a direct air capture unit at that demonstration facility that I showed you that's going on right now. So lots of synergies there with what HIF is doing and what Alaska is doing. So I'll wrap up with the last slide, slide 9. Really just looks at, Alaska has an excellent renewable potential, proximity to these major markets, particularly Asia, significant local jet fuel demand, favorable state administration for this. And then, like I said, e-fuels provides Alaska with this significant new export opportunity, which is to export the wind and renewables in the form of liquid fuels. And so I think what we need really is really just a coordination of the efforts. You had some great presentations today with renewable potential. You know, we need renewable for this these projects. I'd rather team up with somebody developing renewable power than have to develop it ourselves. But the potential is there on the demand side if we can get this all these pieces put together. So with that, I think I'm within my time limit. I've got 2 minutes. So I'll turn it over to questions.
Great.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you for the presentation. I know we have a few questions lined up. I will begin with Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I appreciate it. So, Mr. Meyer, I'm wondering, I'm looking at your last slide here, and I realize you're talking about a northern passage, but and this might, you may not have the answer, but do planes right now, cargo and or other, actually fly over the pole to get to Alaska anywhere?
No, most of the planes from Asia fly over Alaska to get to the Americas. And so that's North and South America. And if you look at the air route, it just is logical. You end up flying over Alaska. And so what they want to do is reduce the fuel weight. And so they can replace that with cargo, stop in Alaska and refuel, and then go on to the Americas.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks.
And that's what makes it such a busy airport, is that the logic of reducing fuel weight because you can stop and fuel in Alaska. The arrows going through the northern route was really for the ships. And even Russia is indicating that the ships on the northern passage should use a low carbon fuel. And the reason is the soot that comes out of the smokestack, if you're burning oil, lands on the ice, and that is exacerbating the melting. And so someday, and IMO, which governs the marine fueling International Maritime Organization, is right now developing low carbon standards for the shipping. They came out with a draft in April. They're going to have clarification of that in June and try and finish it up this year. And what you're going to see there is some low carbon standards for the marine fleets.
Thank you.
Thanks. A couple questions for you. One, in the previous slides, we were talking about gasoline, and I'm just curious, more just as a idle thought for the moment, what is the price of gas made with this process currently, and do you have some projection of how affordable gasoline made by this kind of process can be in the future? I mean, is this a practical, affordable source of gasoline in the future, or does this have benefits because it's green that make it worth some sort of premium?
It is affordable at a premium. And so I've got a saying that that dirty beats clean if the only measure is price, no matter what you're talking about. If you're talking about power, gasoline, no matter what, if it's only price, your dirtiest fuel is going to be your cheapest. So an open smokestack coal plant is cheaper than a smokestack with effluent reduction. So this is a premium price. Think about a $5 to $6 a gallon, which hunts very well in Europe. Not so well in Texas, not so well in the United States, but in Europe it hunts pretty well. Asia, similarly. So clean is a premium, and that's just hard to get around that because you're spending money to remove the carbon.
Fair enough. Thank you for that, Aldo. I was just thinking that $6 a gallon gasoline is pretty darn affordable if you could make that in rural Alaska with a integrated plant tied in with the wind generation. But now I'm just being a little hypothetical. Next question I wanted to ask here is, it seems like there's a chicken and the egg challenge. We have a number of different significant energy projects that are all kind of simultaneously trying to move forward, but not necessarily moving forward, particularly because we don't have any established demand that's really locking in the investability of these projects. And I'm wondering if you have a perspective of how do we unlock the chicken and egg problem of we have these energy projects that need to lock in a demand. You have potentially a demand, but you need some projects that don't exist yet. How do we move ahead in a way that makes sense for the opportunity that you have and the opportunity that the energy producers have? But you both need each other, but it doesn't seem like we've quite met in the middle. Do you have a thought on how we help this process move along?
Well, I'll tell you, I do. And I don't have crystal clarity on that, but my box on that lower right says time to coordinate efforts. Because you've got renewable power developers that need demand. We're a source of demand for the power. We've got to have demand for the offtake, the product. One of the things that one of the earlier questions was, is this like selling gas? Is it similar, to the LNG projects? Part of the difference is, and I've been in both arenas. The LNG is bought by utilities that like long-term contracts. The fuel market is completely different. The fuel market lives on short-term contracts, so it's difficult to get a air, transportation company or a shipping company to sign a long-term fuel contract that has a degree of certainty on the price. So that's part of the challenge globally that this industry is facing, and that's where some of the nations and other groups have stepped up, like Europe has said, okay, you've got to have a blend of this low carbon stuff. And that way everybody sort of gets to be on the same playing field. What I say is that the countries want to decarbonize, companies want to be competitive. And so it's difficult to have one company say, I want to be green, but I may be uncompetitive. And so it's part of that effort. Part of the reason that Porsche is interested and all the Japanese the auto companies are interested, this fuel gives life to the internal combustion engine. And from an energy standpoint, what I say is this is a way to get electricity into the transportation sector without making the transportation sector switch to electric. So instead of making all the cars go to electric, instead let's turn the electricity into a fuel that they can use as is. So that's why the auto companies are interested. But it's an effort that we see moving. So you've got some big companies that are buying. As Mr. Clark, you know, indicated, Japan is a very willing, supportive buyer of this and is doing some things nationally to help this. So it's happening. May not be happening as quick as we want, but I guarantee you it's happening, and Alaska is well positioned geographically to serve those Asian markets.
Great. Thank you. Last question I wanted to ask to kind of follow up on that is that you did mention this time to coordinate efforts, as you've highlighted before. I'm wondering if you have any recommendations or suggestions on what we could do to help create the space or the coordination that would help accelerate those conversations and decisions.
And through the chair, you know, I've got lots of ideas, probably too many to list here, but you've got you know, a number of the agencies that are doing stuff, the universities doing stuff. I think everybody sees the vision, or at least the potential. And it's really a matter, you know, even like myself and Mr. Clark and others, you know, getting together and saying, okay, look, let's not have all these separate little projects. Let's get together and let's make this work and get, you know, the governor on board, which he's on board on these renewables, but in terms of the Japanese effort, the Korean effort, you know, there's lots of attention on the LNG project. Let's get that going on the e-fuels as well, because e-fuels is something that's sustainable for generations. So it's all of that being put together, and I wish I had a better roadmap for you, but it's just a matter of everybody really getting together and saying, hey, look, we've got an opportunity here. Let's go after it just like we're doing these other big projects.
Great. Thank you for that. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you. Just to put a bow on that through the chair, looking at the length of time. So, you know, we're looking at length of time for some fossil fuel projects. I mean, it's been, 50 years? On oil, and we're seeing decline longer than that on natural gas. We're facing decline. But some of these projects that we're looking at for this are, the resource doesn't go away. and so when we're looking into the very far distant future for, you know, another couple generations away, this is a very different scenario.
Well, through the chair, thank you. I agree with you. It's, you know, the renewable resource is renewable. And so if we can convert that into a liquid exportable product that we can use not only in the state but beyond, that's sustainable. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Were there any other questions? I don't see any. Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Meyer, for preparing the presentation, for being here today and sharing your thoughts. I look forward to continuing to work with you. And any updates you can share with us down the road on how we might be able to support the work that you're doing and the partnerships you're trying to develop.
Great. Thank you again.
You bet. So the House Energy Committee will meet on Thursday, May 8th. There we're going to hear from our final two presenters on the potential for tidal and hydropower in Alaska. We'll also be wrapping up with some discussion, some thoughts on where we left off on the renewable portfolio standard HB 153 and some of the other legislation that's been before us as we start wrapping up for this session. So look forward to your time and being able to meet again on Thursday. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:58. Thank you for being here today.